Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society, where we strive to be open-hearted and open-minded. We also try to be humble and be in relationship with each other with integrity. But no matter where you are on this journey of life, this spiritual journey, whatever you want to call it, you are welcome here, no matter your abilities, your inabilities, color of your eyes, color of your skin, no matter your gender identification, or your sexual preference, you are welcome here. If this is one of your first times, we strongly encourage you, of course, to come back. But one reason we want you to do that is that our services on Sunday mornings are very different. Sometimes I do the service. I am Sandy Ingham, Prairie's part-time minister. Sometimes people from outside the congregation do the service, and often members and friends of Prairie will do the service. And again, if you are new, or just visiting, and you wish to introduce yourselves, there'll be a spot for you to do that a little bit later on in the service. The opening words are by Doug Muter. We come together to hold each other up through difficult times. On days when you are feeling intimidated, you can be with people who have courage. When you feel yourself slipping into despair, you can look into the eyes of people who still have hope. We join together because we are stronger that way. Peter, would you light the chalice? Thank you. We light this chalice to honor the flame of radical love that burned within Martin Luther King Jr. We light this flame to remind ourselves to do all within our power to keep that flame alive, especially in the darkest of times. These are the words of Cornell West from his introduction to a collection of Martin Luther King's writings called The Radical King. Cornell West writes, "The FBI transcript of a June 27, 1964 phone conversation reveals Malcolm X receiving a message from Martin Luther King Jr. This message supported the idea of getting the Human Rights Declaration of the United Nations to expose the unfair, vicious treatment of black people in America. Malcolm X replied that he was eager to meet Martin Luther King Jr. as soon as the next afternoon. It didn't happen. If they had met that day and worked together, Cornell West writes, the Radical King would be well known. In a speech to staff in 1966, King explained, there must be a better distribution of wealth, and maybe America must move toward a democratic socialism. If he had lived and pursued this project, the Radical King would be well known. On April 4th, 1968, in Memphis, the last day of his life, Martin Luther King Jr. phoned Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta with the title of his Sunday sermon, Why America May Go to Hell. If he had preached this sermon, the Radical King would be well known. Yet in Dr. King's own time, he would say repeatedly, I am nevertheless greatly saddened that the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment, or my calling. It is no accident that just prior to King's death, 72% of whites and 55% of blacks disapproved of both his opposition to the Vietnam War and his efforts to eradicate poverty in America. King answered his black critics, especially the black ones, with this: "What you're saying may get you a foundation grant, but it won't get you into the kingdom of truth." Although much of America did not know the radical King, and too few know him today, the FBI and the United States government did. They called him the most dangerous man in America. For King, the condition of truth was to allow suffering to speak. For him, justice was what love looks like in public. King indeed had a dream, but it was not the American dream with a small letter D. King's dream was rooted in the capital A, American capital D dream. It was what the quest for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness looked like for people enslaved and Jim Crowed, terrorized, traumatized, and stigmatized by American laws and American citizens. The litmus test for realizing King's dream was neither a black face in the White House, and Cornel West wrote these words after Obama was elected president, neither a black face in the White House nor a black presence on Wall Street. Rather, the fulfillment of his dream was for all poor and working people to live lives of decency and dignity. He called America a sick society. At one point, King cried out in despair, "I have found out that all that I have been doing in trying to correct this system in America has been in vain. I am trying to get at the roots of it to see just what ought to be done. The whole thing will have to be done away with." He said to his dear brother, Harry Belafonte, days before his, King's, death, "Are we integrating into a broken, burning house? Are we integrating into a burning house?" King himself wrote this: As I have moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and to speak from the burnings of my own heart, many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. At the heart of their concerns, this query has often loomed large and loud. "Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix," they say. "Aren't you hurting the cause of your people?" they ask. "And when I hear them," King wrote, "though I often understand the sources of their concern, I am nevertheless greatly saddened. For such questions mean that the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment, or my calling." King's frustration with being misunderstood is heartbreaking. But it is not easy for most of us to grasp the concept of radical love. Radical love will get you killed. Jesus and King both come to mind, not to mention many others. Radical love understands intersectionality, though I don't think it was a term King would have been familiar with. It's so 21st century. All oppressions intersect with each other. All are intertwined. Perhaps we can thank the current administration for bringing this home to us, for helping progressives and liberals realize what intersectionality means, and then with this knowledge, knowing that all oppressions intersect, helping us to be more effective in the fight to end those oppressions. I wrote in my column for the January Prairie Fire newsletter, "Much has been written over the past five decades about Martin Luther King Jr. There is no doubt that he was a great man, an amazing human being. He wasn't perfect, though. He was human. What constitutes greatness in a human being? I don't think that perfection is a measure of greatness. But here are some elements that might be part of greatness, whether we are talking about greatness in an individual or greatness in a nation. First of all, true greatness, I believe, is connected to how clearly reality is perceived and acknowledged. How many of you watched I Am Not Your Negro? What's to say? It's been shown this past week on the public broadcasting system. Will probably be repeated because they do that. This film is all James Baldwin's words, with visuals and all the effects and everything by producer and maybe director, Roel Peck. It's sort of about the deaths of Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King Jr., all of whom James Baldwin knew fairly well. One segment in this wrenching film shows a clip from a movie of the 1950s, I think, with Doris Day and Gary Cooper dancing. This scene is meant to depict life in the white world of that time, or perhaps more accurately, life the way the white world believes it should be. But the dancing, oh boy, did they know how to dance. I love these movies with, I don't know if I ever will love them again, with the dancing. I throw in tap dancing and I'm in heaven. But those film clips are then interspersed in I Am Not Your Negro with clips of actual life, scenes from the black world in this same time period, the late 1950s, early 1960s. And those scenes have not been colorized, which I think was a very wise move. These scenes of life in the black world at that point in time in the history of our country are just so heart-wrenching. I wanted to weep. The clips of the scenes from the black world were ones of beatings of blacks by white policemen, poverty, and the most horrible of all to watch, lynchings. Which depiction of life in the United States and in the 1950s and 60s is the real reality? Which depiction of life in 2018 is the real reality? Martin Luther King Jr. got it. He understood in the deepest part of his being that the real world was not the world that most whites believed in and are bombarded with by movies, television, Madison Avenue. You say, but that was then. That was in the past. That's not the world we live in today. It isn't. The January 1st, 2018 issue of The New Yorker has in one of its articles a statistic about housing segregation after World War II. Quote, after the Second World War, the Federal Housing Administration subsidized the development of suburban communities across America on the condition that homes be sold only to white families. This happened to be an article about gangs in Long Island, El Salvadorian or Haitian gangs. But you see how pervasive, ingrained in us, racism, segregation, white supremacy are? Consider this from Cornel West's Introduction to the Radical King collection. More than 20% of American children live in poverty. That's a horrible figure, isn't it? And nearly 20% live in poverty. Nearly 40% of American children of color live in poverty. West writes, we fail King's litmus test of national greatness. America has many great persons, but it is not a great country. We have mentioned many, many times in this space other glaring examples of racism in this country, income disparity, the overwhelming imbalance of color in our prison populations, DWB statistics, driving while black, drug use, heroin, crack, cocaine, now opioids, drug use that is not taken seriously until it becomes a white problem. So hang on to your seats a minute because I'm going to repeat what I've been saying for several months. We are all, no matter the color of our skin, born into a sea of white supremacy, making each and every white person a white supremacist. Now, I know that you don't want to hear that. I know that many of you will argue, because you already have, with me about the use of the words white supremacist. I know that hearing those words makes you uncomfortable, because it makes me uncomfortable saying them. But bear with me a minute. If we white people are not white supremacists, no matter where we are on the spectrum of white supremacy, and please keep in mind that like everything else, it is a spectrum. If we are not white supremacists, then this country would not look the way it does at this moment. The United States of America would be a very different country today. If we are not deep down complicit, believing that people of all colors want to live their lives the way white people do, then please explain to me any one of the following. Native American genocide, the Vietnam War, our continuing rape of Mother Earth. Rape, period. Rape and abuse of so many groups of people within the Catholic Church, within the Hollywood establishment, within the community of Olympic wannabe gymnasts. The evolution to a place where everything in this country is for sale. The misuse of power, power over women, power over those stuck in poverty, power over the dreamers. It's all connected. And I believe that Martin Luther King understood that. All white people have at least a dollop of white supremacy within themselves, or our world would not look the way it is here well into the 21st century. So we recognize that. We talk about it. We grieve about it. We stop saying, oh, no, we're not. And we get on with it. Because we'll never go forward until we recognize this. It's in our core, however deeply buried. We can't help it. We were born into it. I can't help it any more than I can help the color of my hair, which was not this color originally. But what I can do is acknowledge this flaw within myself, which does not have to be a fatal flaw, though it will be if we don't wake up pretty soon. And I'm talking about both the individual level and the bigger national level. I want to scream to you, get over it, and to myself. But that wouldn't be very helpful. And it also isn't very sensible. We'll never get over it. We can, however, get through it. Work through it. And we do this by seriously looking at what is reality and what isn't. Somehow I don't think that Doris Day and Cary Grant and Fred Astaire, oh, dancing is reality. A nice diversion from reality, which we need sometimes, yes. And it can be useful as long as we return to what is real after we have been diverted and distracted. So, we have to make an honest appraisal, of course, of ourselves, but also of our institutions. Acknowledge our shortcomings and find new ways of being in community with all people. Well, what about this institution? And I'm not going to get into Prairie specifically today, although one of the things I did in the last 3 days was lay some groundwork with other UUs in Madison about working on that, our institutional racism. In an individual congregation. But what about the bigger, the Unitarian Universalist Association? What about that organization? We do keep trying as an association, and that's very, very important. We have to remember that when we look at our failures, we're still trying to do the right thing. So we have to look at our history. As Unitarians and as Universalists, our history of race relations is checkered, to put it kindly. There are some pieces of our history that we are not proud of, but that we need to know about. Gordon Gibson has, who is a retired Unitarian Universalist minister, many stories about our history. Including this one, this is fairly recent history. The year is 1963, And the setting is General Assembly. General Assembly, for those of you who might not know, is an annual meeting of our association of congregations. And it's in different places across the country. And it's where we do our business and we have workshops and we connect with people lots of you use. So 1963, there's a proposed amendment to the Constitution of the Unitarian Universalist Association. This amendment, quote, would have made open membership. I bet you assumed we all had open membership forever and ever, right? This amendment would have made open membership without regard for race, nationality, etc., a stated requirement for admission of any local church or fellowship in the UUA. Open membership. That I know that might seem a little backwards to you. So think about that. Without this amendment, congregations could refuse membership to people of color, for example. The amendment was defeated at that General Assembly, supposedly because it violated the sacredness of congregational polity. Congregational polity is where each congregation gets to do its own thing, kind of. I'm being flippant. There are good things about congregational polity. That was the reason given. And that amendment does contradict our doctrine of congregational polity. But the reality was that the lack of such an amendment allowed some of our congregations to be segregationists and racists, officially. One result of the defeat of this amendment was the formation of the Commission on Religion and Race, and that was the first official commission in a whole series of them, culminating with the commission that was formed at this year's General Assembly. There are always unsung heroes and heroines in history, our Unitarian Universalist history, and all of history. There are so many people, but this is a hopeful thing, whom we've never heard of. Certainly many we've never heard of from the civil rights struggles in the 50s and 60s. I'll bet most of you had never heard of Audrey Fay Hendricks, the little girl in the story. These people have laid the groundwork for us and who are, metaphorically speaking, looking over our shoulders to see how we're doing, how are we faring in the fight to end racism. People like Unitarian minister Ed Cahill, who was not a Unitarian Universalist minister in the 1950s because we hadn't merged yet. In the 50s, as minister of the Charlotte, North Carolina Unitarian Congregation, he challenged that congregation's membership requirements. To become a member, you had to apply for membership, then have the application approved by the board. Most of you probably wouldn't be sitting there here if you had to do that. Well, Cahill did succeed in getting this requirement dropped, and the new membership policy stated, "We wish specifically to make it clear that the doors of the Charlotte Unitarian Church are open to all men, women, and children of this community who wish to enjoy and practice religion dedicated to individual freedom of belief. Neither race, nor color of skin, nor previous religious affiliation matters at all, for our concern is solely with the individual." The part of this story that I particularly like is that the next day, the local newspaper, the Charlotte News, put the story on its front page, right alongside the decision of the Supreme Court in the case of Brown versus Topeka Board of Education. Wow. The history of the Birmingham, Alabama Unitarian Universalists is just full of unsung heroes, including UU ministers Al Hobart and Larry McGinty, and untold numbers of lay leaders. Of course, Birmingham's where our young heroine, Audrey Fay Hendricks, lived. It was unlawful, as I said when the children were here, for a Negro and a white person to play together. But that didn't stop the Birmingham Unitarian Universalist, by now, congregation, from allowing integrated groups such as the City's Council on Human Relations to meet in their space. Al Hobart remembers that at one of those meetings was raided by Bull Connor's police, aided and abetted by the Klan, and Klansmen followed the council members home. Meanwhile, in Jackson, Mississippi, in 1963, a black person wanted to sign the membership book at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in that city. A congregational meeting was called to decide what to do. It was, quote, resolved that a racial test was as inappropriate as a religious test for membership. Good, right? What happened next? The congregation lost 1/4 to 1/3 of its members. Now, an interesting side aspect of this is not written down anywhere. This is oral history. Well, it's been written down now, but it's oral history, which says a lot too. But in the telling of this story, Gordon Gibson, in an attempt to be fair, and I think he's correct here, notes that, yes, there was flagrant bias, but there was, in his words also, all too reasonable fear at play. Then there's Don Thompson, also in Jackson, Mississippi, a Unitarian minister. Most of us know about James Reeb, who died, a Unitarian minister who died in one of the marches. And you might know the names Clark Olson and Orloff Miller. They were with James Reeb. But I suspect very few Unitarian Universalists know the story of Don Thompson, another UU minister during these turbulent times of the 50s and 60s. He was also the executive secretary of the Mississippi Council on Human Relations. In 1965, Gibson relates, Thompson was bushwhacked and nearly died due to a shotgun attack. As he was beginning to recover and return to his work at the Jackson Fellowship and on the Council of Human Relations, he received threats against himself and, quote, anyone in any way associated with him. He left the state with about a day's notice. Who could blame him? Interestingly, the Jackson Fellowship housed one of the earliest Head Start programs, and that was in 1965, so about the same time period. I rest my case a little bit. Greatness is connected to how clearly reality is grasped. Greatness is also connected to humility and integrity, or as Cornel West puts it, radical humility and radical integrity. And this brings us to 2018. Humility, integrity. That is where the Unitarian Universalist Association is. That's where we're trying to be, at any rate, right now, in a space of humility and integrity and reality. Our history demands that we keep on trying, keep on keeping on, despite our flaws, our past mistakes, our bad choices, and our poor judgment. The current angst within our association, the upheavals we have undergone since last spring, are the result of our recognizing that we are on the verge of repeating past mistakes, bad choices, and poor judgment. Here at Prairie in mid-November, we had two services about the mistakes made by the UUA in hiring a regional executive in our Southeast region. Christina Rivera, a self-described Latina Chicana, and one of the finalists for the position, which she did not get, Rivera called us out about our hiring practices. BLUU, which stands for Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism, Blue followed up on what Rivera was saying, pointing out our systemic racism. We can't dismiss or belittle the importance and courage of all those within the UUA who brought this to light, helping us see the reality of our very own racism. A lot of us gulped, gasped, and shuddered. Were we about to repeat what we had done to our brothers and sisters of color in the late 60s and early 70s? And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you can still find my November 12th remarks on our website, right? uuprairie.org/audio/index. You'll find it, right? Please let me know if you want to talk about the backstory, and we'll find a time to do that. But for now, you need to know that there is a line stretching back through our history between what was happening in the early and mid-60s in our southern congregations especially, but a line connecting Cahill, Hobart to Christine Rivera in 2017. There is a line connecting the bumbling and and the stumbling of our association from those late 1960s General Assemblies to the most recent General Assembly, the one in New Orleans in June. For right now, you need to know that no money was misspent in the late 1960s in support of our Black sisters and brothers. I repeat, no money was misspent because no money was spent at all. The delegates at that 1968 General Assembly promised money to our Black brothers and sisters to help end the systemic problems, but the pledge was not honored. The financial pledge was never, ever honored. Max Gabler, Minister Emeritus at First Unitarian Society, was very much involved in all of this, but unfortunately Max is not able to communicate now at 96. There were a number of reasons we didn't honor this pledge. For one thing was all those upheavals. Think about that. Think about what was going on in this country in the late 1960s. Vietnam, Black Power movement, the feminist revolution. All that turmoil was going on. Which one do you pick? How they didn't do intersectionality then. Neither do we, but we're trying to learn how. The newness. Think how new the Unitarian Universalist Association was in the late 60s. We merged in 1961. So we were still learning how to be together. The precariousness of the association's finances at that time. Well, we were deeply in debt, but very few people in power knew this. And finally, I want you to know that despite rumors you may have heard that there would be no oversight of the $5.3 million pledged to Blue and others at this year's 2017 General Assembly, despite of rumors you might have heard that there wouldn't be any oversight, that is not true. Such statements are just that, rumors. Of course there will be monitoring. Of course there will be oversight, just as we monitor any program which we fund and support. 1 million of this 5.3 million has already been raised since June of 2017. Of course, there was one donor who gave that. But sometime within the next few months, I think that all of our congregations will be asked to dedicate at least one Sunday's offering towards the goal of a congregational match of this 1 million. We can do this. Some of that money may be used to introduce a possible eighth principle to our existing seven principles. And of course, the necessary workshops and research and so on and so forth that go into educating ourselves about the principle, which reads like this. We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote, journeying towards spiritual wholeness by working to build a diverse, multicultural, beloved community by our actions that accountably dismantle racism and other oppressions in ourselves and our institutions. WWKD, what would King do if he were alive today? Well, of course, we can't know for sure. I hope he would support women wholeheartedly. I'll really get into that area. Certainly as more and more sexual harassment revelations are uncovered. I'm sure he would do something about supporting the Dreamers and to keep them in this country legally. He would fight for refugees and immigrants. I think he would add environmental degradation to his ever-expanding list of oppressions. WWKD, I like to think that he would applaud our Unitarian Universalist soul-searching and support our adding an eighth principle. You know, King liked us a lot. He went to school in undergraduate, I think, at Boston University, where, you know. It would have been graduate school. Yes, thank you. And he went off and attended the Arlington Street Unitarian Church, and he was a good friend of many UUs, especially some of the higher-ups, like Dana Greeley. So he liked us. Apparently he was often called a closet Unitarian. He spoke at General Assembly in 1966, I believe. And if you ever, I have a copy of what he said. If you want to read that, woof. We honor King. We honor King by admitting our underlying dark side of white supremacy, our potentially fatal flaw. We honor King by vowing to work through this blind spot, through this rottenness, this false assumption. We dishonor King every time we deny that there is some white supremacy in all white people. Can we see reality? Are we humble? Are we people of integrity? True greatness can be measured by these standards, I believe. What would King do? He would remind us that we have power, we have options, we can change, we can admit and understand the work that needs to be done within ourselves, as well as continuing the outer active work. King would tell us to resist tyrants. We can make the choice to carry on his legacy. Just to give you a little shot of energy for fighting the good fight, you might remember that it's probably a whole year ago already that the back of the book, number 579, that someone in power about a year ago thought Frederick Douglass was still alive. We have to keep on keeping on. Nothing worth doing is completed in our lifetime. Therefore, we are saved by hope. Nothing true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we are saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we are saved by love. And no virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as from our own. Therefore, we are saved by the final form of love, which is forgiveness. May it be so. Go in peace, greet your neighbor, stay for Soup Sunday, eat for free if it's your first time, and stay for various meetings.